creator of Outlandish Thefts, played by George Papard. So he's kind of a sexist pig in that guy in a turtleneck rat pack kind of way. Ms. Magazine feminism was in the air, though, indicated by the women guest stars around whom he swanned. Stephanie Powers, Jessica Walter, who flirted with Banachek shamelessly, even as they chided him for his chauvinism, because he had vintage cars and he didn't smoke cigars, just those little cigarillos. Remember those, like what Clint Eastwood pretended to smoke and Fistful of Dollars? Anyway, a more innocent time and yet still sleazy. Playboy's swan song, pre-Penthouse, pre-Hustler, before the internet wiped them all out. But none of that sexist girl-next-door stuff for Banachek. This was sexist corporate woman-next-door stuff. So anyway, centuries ago, Mary Estelle was at the very beginning of that professional woman juggernaut, working within the patriarchy, writing pamphlets and exchanging letters, most famously advocating for women living together in learning dorms like a secular convent or a women's college. Her feminism was pretty basic. Men have souls, women have souls. If women have souls, like men, don't we also have brains, as a matter of fact? Get out of the way, please, and we'll educate ourselves, as with anything gender-related today. This got the fellas all worked up. She got mocked in The Tatler, a magazine helmed by Joseph Addison, kind of the Twitter of the day. No less a wiseacre than Jonathan Swift, writing as Isaac Bickerstaff in The Tatler, invented an assembly of nuns headed by a woman
named Montanella. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists.
Welcome. In this segment of the WHFR Journal, I am excited to talk about teachers. Yay! We love them. I am one. We're wonderful. Tooting my own horn here for a moment, because why not? Ultimately, what would we do without teachers? What would we do without those special people in our lives, in our world, that help make us better, brighter, stronger, more committed, more confident, and every other adjective we might want to imagine. Well, Susan McGraw here. Thank you for tuning in to the Journal today. At this time, we're going to take sort of a different approach as it relates to teachers, where we're going to talk about those teachers that are in training. We call them future teachers. And joining me in our live Zoom today is Diamond J. Arnold. And Diamond is a student here at Henry Ford College and also, coincidentally, the president of the Future Teachers Association. We are looking to promote an event that this organization is co-sponsoring with some other areas on campus. And in our preparation for talking about and coordinating for that promotion, the suggestion was made by Carolyn Cassell, who is in the education area here at the college. Why don't we talk about this club a little bit? So let's jump in. Diamond, it is a pleasure to have you here, and congratulations on your presidency in the Future Teachers Association.
Thank you for having me. Yep. It's so nice to talk to you and just to get the information of the FTA out so we can promote the club and get some more teachers and just any type of encouraging students to get more diverse backgrounds into our club. That's what our goal is.
You as a member are sort of, again, promoting the opportunity for people to join. But as a student, what does being a part of the club mean to you? How is it a benefit to you in your phase of this part of your career?
Yeah, so this is my last year at Henry Ford before I go off to university, and it's really just giving me that hands-on experience that I need and practice, because we have much events that we do at FTA, just meetings to talk and just keep that teacher interaction going, get those peers, those teacher peers. So it's been helpful for me just to meet friends and also to develop leadership skills as well.
Yeah. Do you have to be at a certain position, sort of a certain, I'm this far now in a program specific to becoming a teacher to be a member of the FTA? How does that work?
No, you just have to be majoring in pre-education or have an interest in pre-education even, and you can join. Yeah.
Where are you at? You said you have a year left. And then what is the next step for you? What's your goal?
Wayne State University to finish my teaching degree.
Where do you want to end up? Where do you want to land?
Just K-3. I'm thinking about maybe being a kindergarten teacher. I already have the school district picked out and did some field work there already. So excited.
Have you found at any phase of working with the Future Teachers Association, with other members of the organization, that the sort of the motivation or the mindset of, I want to be a teacher, I have this passion. When you're maybe not feeling as passionate because of who knows what, as a teacher, I know there are struggles, right? Mm-hmm. Do you find that it's sort of one of those kind of comrade kind of a thing? Like when somebody's maybe going through a little bit of a challenge and you kind of help each other out through those times?
Yes, I do. Actually, our last teaching meeting, we were having a talk about stress and different ways that we deal with stress. Some people were saying they take a walk, some people take a shower. So we definitely depend on each other when it gets tough, because teaching is very taxing.
I know in this day and age, while we have many wonderful teachers that are getting older and getting into that retirement phase, and we have a pool of teachers that are always, you know, looking for work, there seems to be that sort of middle spot where there are districts that are struggling to find good quality help and support. How much of those types of discussions go on through the Future Teachers Association? I know I read one of the objectives is to promote career actual opportunities in teaching. So how much of that kind of discussion takes place, and where do you find support for learning about opportunities?
Well, our professor, the head of it ahead of me, she is really good at bridging that gap between the younger and the older teachers and kind of making it a little more modernized. We do a lot of work at William Ford Elementary. So that's kind of where we get our hands-on events, our hands-on experience. And those teachers, principal and assistant principal, are very nice, very welcoming. They give us an intro and outro every time, always open to feedback, and just really nice and pleasant to talk to. So I feel like that's the resource and the people that you go to if you ever need that extra help as a teacher.
One of the events forums, it's more like a presentation, I suppose, if you will, that's coming up beginning of the new year, is what kind of led us to have this connection. And that is one of many different events that, as you've indicated, you present for the larger community. So while teaching is a learning experience for those that want to do it as a craft, it's also a way for the community at large to benefit through some of the information, because it really seems like some of what as teachers are being trained to do is good advice across the board, no matter what your profession is going to be. Can you kind of speak to that a little bit?
I think just the ethics of being a teacher are important across the board for every profession, as you said, as well as just organization and teamwork that you use. So yeah, I think those are definitely helpful skills in every profession, for sure.
How much community service at your stage of education do you do?
We do a lot of events in the classroom about learning outside the classroom, such as like we just had a sewing event teaching fourth graders how to sew. So that's helpful. So we try to kind of implement different skills outside of just like the basic curriculum in school, like math, science, and just those real life, like community building skills. But now that you said something, I am going to maybe think of an event that has more to do with the community.
As a teacher, I'm proud of what I do, and I'm sure you're proud of the effort you've taken so far to get to where you are now. You know, it always seems like teachers, we just need to spotlight them more. We all think of our favorite teacher at some point, and sometimes that is just enough to get you through something as an individual. So I'm all about spotlighting all the hard work that goes on. So yes. Yeah, I love that community stuff. So
in front and behind the scenes, for sure.
In terms of the concept of makeup of the club, you mentioned that you're looking for additional people to just provide some different perspectives and so on. Roughly how many members do you have, and where do you connect? How often do you meet, and all those particulars?
So we have about one or two meetings a month, depending on if there's other events going on, every other Wednesday morning, like 10 to 12, 10 to 11, on Zoom. So it's all virtual. You don't have to come to the campus or do anything overextending yourself. We have the professor, me, the president, a vice president, and a secretary as well. And we get about like 6-7 people at every meeting, regulars, just always looking for more people to come. We can have that diversity in there.
In your experience as an educator that is still in the learning phase, what are some of the biggest things that you perceive as challenges to be really successful in your role and in your desire to do that K-3, what do you think might be the biggest hurdles and the biggest challenges?
Biggest challenges. I think just the growing, changing world, especially with technology added, and just how we as teachers have to learn how to implement this technology in the classrooms, And just with all the struggles of the world and dealing with children's emotional at home as well as school life, I feel like that's probably the hardest challenge as a teacher these days. Really, the home life affects the learning process. So I feel like having that personal student-teacher relationship helps a lot. Also having a relationship with the parents and just really being involved on a deeper level than just teaching the student information, really getting them to fully learn it and adapt just to their life. Does it relate to their life? Why should they care? Things like that. I feel like that's the challenge.
We kind of can't change what, you know, those circumstances that are out there, but we can help students navigate and make, you know, have a better life because of it. We've got a special event coming up in the new year, beyond the one that you mentioned. It is part of the children's author series. Yeah. And you've got Miss Rita coming in. Can you tell us what that's all about?
Rita Talley, she is coming to read her new book, Nora's Extraordinary Superpower. And that is February 7th. So that's exciting. We are looking forward to that. We have a lot of reading events in the club. So
when you say reading events, so she'll be coming in and reading some excerpts or reading the whole book?
Reading the whole book, is, and you can bring your children as well.
As a part of the different things that you're doing as president of this organization, is there something that you are still working towards that you haven't quite accomplished yet? A special guest, a special project, a special something that you've got your sights set on?
Everything was okay until you mentioned the community lesson event. I think I'm going to work on something for that for next semester. You planted a seed right there. But yeah, just getting the students in the elementary out into the community, I feel like that would be a good lesson for FTA to do.
At the event, at our play event that I mentioned, we've got students coming in from area schools, and I got to meet or see in person Carolyn Cassell. Tell us a little bit about the program and about Carolyn and how your experience is going.
Yeah, I'm taking two of her courses this semester. So she is a great teacher. She truly is. And she always just reminds us of dates and not to stress, which is great because it can get very stressful around midterms and finals. And she's just always trying to get events, get people active thinking. I really take that as a teacher and I admire that. And I want to put that on my own practice as well. So always be encouraging my students to be thinking and active and doing something. So she's great. She's wonderful.
It really seems to me that when we talk about opportunities for students on campus, organizations like the Future Teachers Association, which brings together like-minded people looking for the same end goals, but being open and willing to kind of creatively share your own experiences as well as your own interests, challenges, concerns, really is a support system that's pretty valuable. So we do encourage those that are interested to find out more and to learn more, and potentially if this early education is for you, look into the Future Teachers Association here at Henry Ford College. How can we reach you, and what would be the next steps if we've got somebody interested in participating?
You can reach the FTA at djarnold1@hawkmail.hfcc.edu. And the next steps would be to come to our meeting in December. I believe our next meeting is, because November was a very busy month. So yes, just email me. And as soon as we make the flyer for the next meeting, I will email it to you and you can come and join the club. Get started on your teaching journey.
Thank you, Diamond, so much for your time today. It sounds like you're very passionate about what you do and what you want to do. And we wish you and the entire organization continued success and hope that you will be out there soon enough, molding the minds of our young people and making the world a better place, which is what teachers do. So appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This is the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here. Stay with us.
I'm Scarlett Johansson. My family relied on public assistance to help provide meals for us. These meals fueled my involvement in theater and the arts as a child, which fostered my love for acting. The Feeding America network of food banks helps millions of people put food on the table. You can join the movement to end hunger by donating, volunteering, and advocating. Because when people are fed, futures are nourished. Join the movement to end hunger at feedingamerica.org/act now. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
I learned patience from my adoptive dad. All he had to say was,
"Hey, you got this. Just breathe." Hey. Hey, we're pretty good.
Yeah.
Might have to start a band.
I got it.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUS Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Welcome to this Friday edition of the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw with you. And boy, I'm hearing music as I go into this next segment. And yes, there's a reason for it. But I love, first of all, indicating that when I do most of my work here on campus, I get to sit in a beautiful building called the McKenzie Fine Arts Center, which is the F building, the Fine Arts building. And what I love about spending my time in this particular building is that I get to hear the musicians tuning up their instruments and the performers, the singers, tuning up their instruments, which are their voices. So it's no wonder I hear music an awful lot. I also love music, and this is a radio station, so it's a good fit. Speaking of good fits, I am going to welcome for the first time, making her inaugural debut into the world of broadcast radio, the new HFC Director of Chorus, Amy Sari. Amy, I can't wait to get to know you a little bit. I know our listeners are going to love to hear what brings you to this campus and what you're bringing to our students. So first of all, welcome to WHFR.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure to have you here. Tell us a little bit about your history as it relates to this current position that you're in. Where did it all start for you, and sort of, what brought you to the steps before you finally got to us here at HFC?
Oh my goodness. Well, it has been more than 25-year journey to get to this point. The first time I ever conducted choir was as a senior in high school in Des Moines, Iowa, at Des Moines North High School. Our choral teacher was interested toward the end of the year to involve student conductors as part of our performance project. And normally a lot of high school music teachers have student accompanists, but our teacher was very unique, and so she decided to try having student conductors, and I was one of three who were selected to conduct pieces for our spring concert. And the moment I had my opportunity to be on stage and do that, I was hooked on it. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to pursue it through Grinnell College and also at Bowling Green State University, where I received master's in choral conducting and composition. And then after that, found myself in the Great Lakes area. My first position in Michigan was conducting a church ensemble in Rochester, Michigan. And from there, I started to go through this long metamorphosis through many different performance opportunities. You know, I tried my hand at a lot of different things, and I found myself coming back to choral conducting in the wake of COVID and the pandemic, when I was directing a church choir. And I was noticing that, you know, we all remember the pandemic. One of the major things that folks remember about the devastation of that period in time was that choral rehearsals across the country and across the world shut down. And there was a lot of devastation because all of a sudden singers were isolated from one another. And it actually gave the whole profession and the whole practice, people involved in it, the opportunity to sit back and start considering bigger questions around what is choral music for, and what is the role of the choral director? And the conversation started to include ideas of social justice. There were choral directors that were finally addressing the issue of social justice in a way that I had never heard before. And I was very intrigued by the conversation because it was an issue that I observed in my life amongst my singers and within myself. And so as the lockdown conditions started to lift, I found myself taking on like a whole new sort of personal, you know, mission statement to have my my music practice be in pursuit of social justice for people around me. That's what led me to work with the Sing Out Detroit chorus, which is a local LGBTQ plus an ally chorus, and also to pursue the music ministry at Metropolitan Community Church of Detroit, which is a LGBTQ plus an ally oriented church. And in the midst of all this, I saw the opportunity to become a choral director here. And it seemed like a really good fit because education is a social justice pursuit as well. And so I saw myself continuing my own self-education into what that means for me as an artist and a musician. And I'm definitely interested in opening that conversation up in academia. So that pursuit has led me to the project that I am in now in directing the HFC chorus alongside Gianna Hunter, who is a very, very talented and admirable director of her vocal jazz ensemble, Blue Fusion. So I am now, deeply invested in this conversation, and that is the thing that motivates me here and now.
Well, I'm deeply invested in this conversation as well, the one that we're having, and boy, you've given us a lot to consider there, and so much so that it comes back to turning something negative into something positive, or finding the positive in the negative, and isn't that sort of what it's about? So while some organizations just decided to give it up with the pandemic, others I know also shifted. Our former music maestro, Kevin Dewey, Kevin Dewey here at HFC, he went into an online component with some of his music, and they did some really cool different types of, you know, performing and rehearsals and so on. And that was interesting and unique, but in some ways, the word inauthentic isn't appropriate, but I kind of, you know, it was cool. It was wonderful to keep that spirit going and the opportunity to continue to sing.
Certainly.
But, you know, I haven't seen, in my own experience, too many choirs releasing those types of performances at this point. It's back to that face-to-face, that collective spirit, that one voice in a room together kind of a thing, which
yes.
I suspect is ideal, and certainly the way I like to see it performed and hear it performed, although right now technology, right, we can do all sorts of great things,
of course.
But the opportunity to be able to literally be back together post-pandemic and move forward is I think a wonderful thing. So I'm really glad that you came in when you did, Amy, first of all, but second of all, working with the pre-existing music program here, and we've got some things in flux, as we know. Some others came in at the same time as you, directing some different areas of the music program under the current overarching direction of our interim music faculty, Anthony Lai.
Yes.
So there's a lot going on, let's just put it that way. For those people that have thought to themselves, well, she sounds cool. I like to sing. Mm-hmm. I haven't been in a chorus since high school, grade school, my church.
Right.
But I kind of might like to pick this up again. I need a creative outlet.
Mm-hmm.
I might like to do this here at HFC. What would you say to that student to make the first approach, to take the first step?
Well, the thing that is really on my lips to say right now to that is there's room for you.
Mm.
There's room for you. And I will say also that, you know, this semester, the singers that I have worked with in this sort of like new incarnation of the choir is composed largely of not only, you know, longtime members, but also new people, new students, people who are new to ensemble singing. And I would also say that, you know, given, you know, what I've shared about, you know, like music being a social justice pursuit, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And like that, and the conversation around like reimagining what is possible for vocal ensemble music, the time has never been better for people to see themselves singing and being a part of the arts conversation, because the time has never been better for us to ask serious questions about, okay, well, what really is a choir? What are our assumptions about it? Where do those assumptions come from? You know, and what one of the things that I would refer to is take for instance, like the voice parts, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hear those terms, what you got to realize that there are cultural assumptions and stereotypes associated with those terms. And it makes me wonder how many vocal artists have considered where those terms originate, how have they evolved over time, and what do they actually mean? Because we use those terms to pigeonhole people and to put them in boxes, you know, and we don't consider that there is cultural baggage around that. There is also gender policing involved in that as well. And so, you know, and now that I say that, it kind of makes us think about, okay, like why do we divide voices on this basis?
Mm.
How can we reimagine vocal ensemble performance outside of the stereotypes and the gender policing that we have imposed upon ourselves as musicians? Can we imagine something better? If we are saying that we are artists, how can we imagine a better framework in which to pursue the vocal arts and what they mean and what story are we telling? Whose story are we telling? And how are we to be responsible for the stories that end up in our hands and that we have the responsibility to tell?
Mm-hmm. Can we? Can we do those things?
I'm hoping.
And how are we going to do those things?
Yeah.
More importantly, how are you going to do those things, Amy? Sorry.
Well, how I'm going to do those things is the thing that is right there for me to say is to remain in the question.
Mm.
To remain in the question and to never have a final answer. Because this is an evolving art form. This is an evolving conversation. And, I mean, yes, I'm a professor. Yes, I'm a teacher. Yes, I have, you know, a couple of letters behind my name. But that only means that, you know, if you are a teacher, you are also bound to the process of learning. And that means, and that is as much true for me as any student that I work with. So there are things that, because I have students coming to me, they, some of them want to be teachers themselves. And I remember, you know, the dean at the College of Music at BGSU once said, if you don't teach, the art dies with you. So for people who find themselves, you know, involved in art, in the arts, and, you know, at any level with any practice, it is not just something that you could hold for yourself, but it is something that is shared with others. Music is about people. And if we don't, you know, engage with other people and keep asking the questions and keep fielding answers and getting those stories and being willing to honor the stories of people that come to work with us, you know, art forms die when you don't allow them to evolve in this way.
That was a very profound answer. I appreciate you taking on that challenge of that question that I threw at you there. Amy Saar is joining us. She is the new director of the HFC Chorus and her first semester here at Henry Ford College, first semester teaching at the collegiate level, but certainly not without years and years of experience, as she shared earlier, and as I have the pleasure of reading from our HFC website. We are here on this edition of the Journal. We are into the end of November. And yes. And we certainly say, of course, a happy Thanksgiving for next Thursday to those of you that will be celebrating. Music serves as a celebration.
Yes.
For so many people in so many environments. Mm-hmm. Music can also serve as a source of comfort and
yes.
a source of solace.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very powerful and emotional thing. And it kind of sounds like what you're talking about is really speaking to that sort of kind of that bigger concept of what music, you know, what can we do for music, but what can music do for us? I
yes.
suppose the question goes both ways.
Oh, yeah.
In your approach here, just a few months into Henry Ford College, you sort of inherited a choir, yes, and you inherited some sort of people to work with and so on. What do you think this starting point, you know, has excelled at? What are you most excited about right now with the current, you know, the current point of where you are, sort of newer in our program here? And what would you like to see short term and maybe even long term as we move forward?
Yes. Yeah. No, thank you for that. One thing that I can say that I'm most, you know, happy and proud of, and, you know, with the group as it is right now, we have, we just got back from a participation in the Michigan Community College Choral Festival in Grand Rapids, mm-hmm. Grand Rapids Community College. They have hosted this event for a number of years, and Kevin Dewey, the previous director, has brought, you know, this group to that event many, many times. And this year was my first opportunity to bring the group there and kind of like reintroduce ourselves to the community of the community college. And so I had no idea what to expect, but I knew that, well, we'd better be prepared for anything. And that means to make sure that we have pieces to bring that are, you know, all the way up to performance level, and to be, you know, open to whatever happens, and to be able to receive coaching, and also to network, and it was, you know, and not just for me, but for the singers as well, to find out, okay, what is the community college choral scene about? You know, who are these people?
That's a pretty important question,
yeah,
isn't it? Yeah.
I was most impressed, you know, by the Henry Ford College Chorus's performance of three amazing pieces from our own repertoire and also our performance, participating with the all of the other singers on the combined piece. We did the chorus Va Pensiero by Verdi from his opera Nabucco. And our singers took to it like ducks to water. Absolutely loved it. As a matter of fact, you know, we did so well. We were the only college chorus that came in. We memorized all of our pieces. We brought ukulele. We also brought performance art with our performance of Kuumba by Zenaida Stewart Robles, which is a very fascinating piece. But all the pieces that we did there, Over the Rainbow, What a Wonderful World, also Everyday People, as well as Va Pensiero, all of those pieces are going to be on our winter concert program December 3rd. And I have to tell you, I am so excited for the musicianship that we were able to show, the blend that we've achieved, you know, and the excellence that we brought to the experience, and you know, everybody taking in the experience, even if it was their first time in that setting. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to do more of that.
Mm. Where will we see this on December 3rd, and who can attend?
This performance will be at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Dearborn, and we will be joined by Blue Fusion, directed by Gianna Hunter. They will do a set with us. And the set is going to be full of amazing pieces, not just choral pieces, but also solo and duet projects to give our students a chance to shine and, you know, in all of their very peculiar ways.
Love it. Love it. And I know that if you check out the HFC website, hfcc.edu, you will see details of this and so much more as it relates to the music program and the HFC chorus. Amy, it has been a pleasure getting to know you so far this semester.
Thank
you. Look forward to viewing your work and listening to your work. I have to circle back to in the first part of our discussion when you said that it was that instant that you knew you wanted to do this.
Yeah.
And you had the chance, it was ninth grade, I think you said. You had the chance to...
Senior in high school.
Oh, senior in high school.
Exactly.
Okay, so
12,
oh, that was way far back. So senior in high school.
Forever ago.
Yeah, which was a rare opportunity for you. Do you remember the piece that you directed?
It was an arrangement of America the Beautiful. Yeah, I don't remember who the arranger was or anything about it, but it was an arrangement of America the Beautiful, and I and the ensemble consisted of all of the singers in the entire vocal music department, so freshman through senior. It was a wall of singers, and it was intimidating but also very exciting. So yeah, I'll never forget that moment.
Wow. We are looking forward to you joining the choir if it is something that you see fit to do. Mm-hmm. If you'd like to learn more, I'm sure Amy would be more than happy to talk to you about options and roles and so on. So, Amy, how might someone reach out to you directly?
Well, my email should be on the site.
Perfect.
I'm definitely reachable via email. Definitely welcome to come see our concert and meet with me and with the other singers and to see what we can envision for the future of the program.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like whatever you envision it is going to be unusual and eclectic and inclusive and stimulating and thought-provoking and all those things that music should do for the listener as well as the performer. And we're glad that you are such a part of it. So welcome officially to Henry Ford College, to WHFR Radio.
Thank you.
And I have a feeling we'll be talking a good amount more to you as
Certainly.
Things move forward. But congratulations. You succeeded in your first official interview.
Right, yeah.
And yay. And we're really glad to have you as a part of our team.
Thank you again, Susan.
Thank you. This is the WHFR Journal. Again, Amy Sari, director of the HFC Chorus. If you'd like to learn more, simply check out our website, hfcc.edu. We've got more on the way. Do stay with us.
Hello. Welcome to WHFR 89.3. I am the Diva. My show, Lyrical Infusion, is live on air Saturdays 5 to 8 p.m. It's not really a show. It's a whole vibe. It's me, the Diva. Add music, and it's live. 89.3, and we're still making waves.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and catch the bus. Text and miss your stop.
Wait.
Text and be late to work.
Sorry, I'm late.
Text and work. Text and pretend to work. Text and act surprised when someone calls you out for not working.
Who, me?
Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time.
Ugh.
Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
I'm Lee C. Camp. This is No Small Endeavor, exploring what it means to live a good life. If you're like me, you might depend on structure. For me, it's daily habits and practices that keep me between the ditches, as we used to say in Alabama. So when something like the holidays come up and throw my normal routines off, all of the strategies I employ on a daily basis can get discombobulated. Throw in a mix of family and societal expectations, and often holidays can go from rapturous joy one moment to what the heck just happened the next. Of course, you don't know what I mean, I suspect. Well, maybe you do. But for the benefit of at least me, we've put together a companion guide for the holidays, a sort of how-to. How to have great conversations that are meaningful, that will facilitate authentic human connection, along with some practices and examples of them that can facilitate genuine gratitude in a way that just might make for a happy holiday. You'll hear Heather Holloman share surprisingly practical tips on how to have a great bonding conversation that makes people feel seen and heard, and that might even transcend politics at the dinner table. Community activist Diane Latiker will share with us how she opened up her home and changed the trajectory of a neighborhood through hospitality. And then Oliver Berkman, author of the runaway bestseller 4,000 Weeks, reveals how acceptance of the transient nature of our lives can help us live in the moment, thereby transforming even the most mundane occurrences. All that will give you something like an ideal toolkit for heading into the holidays with gratitude and some engaged conversation. But we start today with music sensation Amy Grant, who has an astoundingly simple practice to keep one grounded in the moment. 5 weeks before her 16th birthday in 1976, the teenaged Amy Grant was offered her first record deal. These days, after tens of millions of record sales, 6 Grammys, a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, along with a highly prestigious Kennedy Center honor, she is one of the most widely recognized names in American pop music. But this past year, Amy was in a traumatic bicycling accident that left her severely injured. Her response is a remarkable lesson in how to practice gratitude. The last year has been pretty wonderful and, I guess, tumultuous for you, and tumultuous in a recent accident that has affected your memory some, and then at the same time, this prestigious honor at the Kennedy Center. What are some of the highs and lows then of this experience over the last 12 months for you?
Oh, my goodness. The last 12 months have been a real gift to me. I was in a biking accident, and I don't remember it, so I don't have any trauma from that. But that led to a surgery to repair my shoulder in the end of September, and then the Kennedy Center honors was in December, and then I had another surgery that happened. It was actually on my throat the end of January because I had a pre-existing cyst, thyroglossal cyst, anyway, that unbeknownst to me was actually affecting my singing. It was getting harder and harder for me to sing. And something about that bike accident caused the growth of that cyst to go into hyperdrive.
Huh.
And so it was interfering with my swallowing. I had to have it taken out. And so these are the gifts from all of, from that year. So the end of July, I had everything came to a grinding stop. I did have a head injury. I had to be on no screens, no phone, nothing for a couple of months. They had to wait to make sure that my brain was okay before they could operate on my shoulder. My friend who was on the bike ride with me said, you kept saying over and over three things in the emergency room. You kept saying, something's wrong with my shoulder. I can't believe I still have all my teeth. And I needed this. Yeah, and so the curiosity in me has explored the fact that I kept saying those things over and over again. I needed this. I have just tried to say, how all did I need it? And one of the things is, because I started singing so young and because I had people around me that dreamed and schemed with me and toured with me and who managed me, who booked me, there was always a group around me who also paid their bills because of what I did.
Hmm.
My life was laid out always in advance. And in a way that prioritized things about my time that it wasn't until everything totally stopped that I thought, I wonder on a level playing field, had I not ever sung, how would I have invested differently? And in the short run, what I saw was I had the chance to invest in a new way with my adult children who, thinking they might have lost their mom. And this was 2 years after I also had surprise open heart surgery that was totally fine. I feel better than ever. But all of us can be oblivious or unaware of how we feel about our investment in another person or their investment in us. And that really was kind of a slap to all of us saying, what a gift we have in each other. But even at the Kennedy Center, I was so glad I didn't have to sing for that. I was so glad I didn't have to actually say very much. And I did go up and receive the award at a private dinner. I didn't have a speech. All I did was wiggle my toes. And I just said, I will speak the truth of whatever comes into my head.
Hmm.
The overwhelming gift of feeling, I do feel like I see life through a different lens since last summer. And I think there are some things that are probably changed about me. I don't know if it was the blow to the head. I feel like part of my filter is gone.
For good or for ill, I suppose.
I just feel so much gratitude for right now, all the possibility of right now. And it makes everything more precious because for the first time in my life, I have felt very aware that the resources of time, talent, treasure, ability, all those things, our resources are limited.
Yeah. Right.
And so what we do matters, and we can't do everything.
Yeah. I'm struck by something you just said that I want to follow up on. So wiggle my toes and speak the truth as it comes into my head. That seems to me pretty worth meditating on at some length. Mm. And I can speculate, but why wiggle your toes?
The morning of my mother's funeral, I was rushing around. I had planned several things to say. I had sort of loose notes. I got a call from Sheryl Crow, who lives in Nashville. She's one of three sisters, also a great relationship with her mother. And we don't see each other often, but we have a really dear friendship. And she happened to call me. And that morning I said, I was so rattled. I said, I'm getting ready to go speak at my mom's service, and I'm so afraid I'm just going to start crying and not be able to function.
Hmm.
And I think this is what her mother told her.
Hmm.
But she said, wherever you are, wiggle your toes. If you will wiggle your toes, it will connect you to the moment. It will remind you that you're in the present. And you'll return to yourself. You'll return to the moment in which you stand. And that advice was very helpful that day. And it came from Cheryl. It's been helpful so many times in my life.
I suspect I'm going to remember that one. So, at the dinner table this holiday, if your mind starts racing, projecting all manner of possible horrible things might happen, or if you find there's something worth being sad about and find yourself wanting to go numb and not feel what seems to be required, maybe just try wiggling your toes. It might just bring you back to the present. Every year, No Small Endeavor stages a live show the Sunday evening prior to Thanksgiving here in Nashville.
This is No Small Endeavor. I'm Lisa Camp.
In one of those shows at the Ryman Auditorium, we welcomed Diane Latiker to tell her story of hospitality amidst a Chicago neighborhood racked by gun violence. Diane is the founder of Kids Off the Block, an organization which seeks to give refuge to inner-city youths against rampant gang activity and violence, serving over 3,000 children to date. In the midst of tragedy, Diane chose to open her front door to those in need. In 2011, Diane was named one of CNN's heroes. Her story reminds me there's a deep gratitude that comes in the wake of seeking to make a difference in other people's lives. Dan, tell us, how did you get started in doing this work that you've been doing for 13 years, right?
15 years.
How did you get started with that?
So my husband and I have 8 kids. We have 4 boys and 4 girls. That's what I said. No. Anyway, we had one at home, Aisha. She was 13 years old. My other kids were grown and they were gone. So I wanted Aisha to graduate from high school and go to college. And I wanted to keep up with her. So I took her and her 9 friends skating and swimming and all that stuff to keep them occupied. My mom said, Diane, you should do something with those kids. They like and respect you. And in my mind, I'm going, no, I don't want to do this. I'm going to be able to go fishing and be free when Aisha's gone. But I prayed about it for 3 days. And I just asked them to come into my home. So that's how it started, with 9 kids from my neighborhood.
And 3,000 kids later, you've ministered to.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much.
So tell us more about the neighborhood that you're a part of.
The neighborhood is fighting against itself with violence. There's a lot of hopelessness. That's one of my biggest things, though, is giving kids hope and making them believe that they are worth living past 21, because they don't believe that. And the neighborhood itself is economically depressed, poverty. But that still is not a reason to give people hope. So that's what we do. That's what we try to do.
In the midst of that, I'm very moved by some of the stories from a CNN story who's recognized you as one of their top heroes.
Yes.
But the story about the monument that you've done. Yeah. Tell us about that.
There's a memorial for young people killed by violence across the street from my house. It started in May of 2007 from Blair Holt. He was a 16-year-old honor roll student. He was on his way home on CTA bus, and a young man, a 14-year-old, got on the bus and sprayed the bus, kept trying to kill somebody else, and it killed Blair. When my daughter had went to school with Blair and I knew his father, I was angry. I was tired of marching and rallying and meeting. It wasn't working. And I was at Home Depot, and I saw these stones, and they looked like little headstones. And I bought 30 of them. That's all the money I had. I bought 30. And I put up this memorial about this high, and I said, I want to shock my community, and I want to shock the young people. We're losing generations to violence. That memorial, we've rebuilt it now 15 times. It has almost 800 stones in it. We are behind 400. We can never catch up. These young people are 24 years and down. We don't go over 24 years. The youngest is a 1-year-old who was getting her diaper changed. Sorry. She was getting her diaper changed, and they were trying to kill her father. So that's the memorial is just to shock my community. I had no idea it would grow the way it has, but I'm still wondering why it's no outrage. Those young people belong to a family. They belong to somebody. Somebody loved them.
What happens when you see young people come see that memorial, that monument?
I've seen so many of them go and get a job, go back to school. It literally, like, because most of their friends are in it. So it literally, I've seen them change their lives in front of it.
Tell us a story about a challenge that one of the kids transcended that you hold on to as a reminder of possibilities.
There was a 13-year-old named Maurice. 13 years old, 7th grade, knocked on my door one day and said, "Are you Miss Diane?" I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Well, I want to change my life." I said, "Excuse me, you had no life. You said you're 13. What are you talking about?" He said he was robbing people and he was beating up other kids. And I let him into my house, and come to find out, the school hated, the teachers didn't like Maurice. Nobody liked Maurice. But his mom was a drug addict, and he slept on concrete floors as a kid. And when I found all that out, I said, "What do you want, Maurice? What would make you happy?" He wanted to play football. He was angry because his mom couldn't take him to football practice. He couldn't get in football. His grades were terrible because he was acting up. So he got his grades up. He graduated 8th grade, mentored 3 third graders, and then he got on the football team as a starter. And he went on to do great things. And the last time I talked to him, he thanked me on CNN. CNN came out and did a piece, and he actually said thank you because I opened my front door.
So this weekend, this past weekend, you had your 12th annual Thanksgiving dinner.
Yes.
With kids coming in from Yes. different gangs in peace around a table.
6 gangs at one time have been at this dinner. Do I have a minute just to tell how that started? 2 kids came to my house the first year. "Miss Diane, can we eat dinner with you on Thanksgiving?" "Yeah, come on in." The second year was 5. Me and my mom said, "Okay, come on." The third year was over 20. Me and my mom said, "No, we got to do something." We got a nice donor to donate a tent. We put it on a vacant lot across the street. We got a caterer to donate a real Thanksgiving meal. And we had over 100 kids and their families come out that year. In 2016, we had over 800. Yesterday, we had our 12th annual. Chicago kicked our butt with the weather. So it wasn't 800, but it was over 400 that came out yesterday and enjoyed a Thanksgiving meal with their families.
Marvelous. Please thank Diane.
Thank you all.
Listening to No Small Endeavor and our holiday special entitled Conversation and Gratitude. No Small Endeavor is also a podcast. We explore what it means to live a good life and are honored to bring a great variety of perspectives with remarkable guests, like our episode with James Lawson, whom many credit as the conscience of the American Civil Rights Movement and one of the chief architects of the movement's nonviolent resistance. Or our conversation exploring our dopamine-addicted brains and what to do about them with New York Times best-selling author Anna Lemke. Or our special interview with Martin Sheen of West Wing fame on his extensive activism for peace and justice, leading to his being arrested more than 60 times. You can join us by searching for No Small Endeavor wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, Heather Holloman gives us very practical advice on how to have meaningful and connecting conversations that leave others feeling seen and known.
This has been a special version of the WHFR Journal, along with another special program called No Small Endeavor. And coming up next at the top of the hour, we will enjoy Highway 61, featuring, of course, the hostess with the mostest, your friend and mine, Kitty Love, coming up next here on WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves at 89.3 and WHFR.FM. Background sounds are none other than Ramsey Lewis from his CD called Tequila Mockingbird and a song called Wandering Rose. And we're going to make way for Kitty Love and Highway 61 up next here on WHFR 89.3 and WHFR FM.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Hi, this is Terrence of the Play It By Ear Jazz Show. Want to wish everyone out there the happiest of holidays, and with everything that has been going on with me, I'm very grateful to be alive.
Clarksdale, south.